All right.
Okay, we started last week in the book of Genesis, just kind of barely got going in it. And we saw a few things of background information. I guess the thing works both ways. Who wrote this book? Moses wrote it, didn't he? How do you know that? Because the Lord said he wrote it. Remember we saw that verse in Luke where the Lord said, speaking about himself, that beginning with Moses on down to everything, that information was there. The opposing viewpoint is called the documentary hypothesis. That's the viewpoint that men have come up with and says, nah, guys about the time of Nehemiah and long and through there collected a bunch of stuff and put it together, and that's what we have. We don't think that's correct at all. The Lord said it was written by Moses. It is therefore written by Moses. The character of this book is that it means what? What does the word Genesis mean? Beginnings or origins. And we see a whole bunch of different ones there. We see nearly all, probably we see all of the building blocks of the society of man have their beginnings in this book. And that's what the name itself means, is origins. Probably written about the time of the Exodus, maybe after the Exodus, during the initial 40 years of wilderness wanderings, maybe along and through there it appears. And Moses' purpose is to explain to his readers how God uses men like him as theocratic administrators. He's done it in the past, and he's doing it with Moses. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, all of those guys fulfilled that role, and now Moses was fulfilling it, and he was there to redeem or deliver, and he was wanting them to follow him and obey him, and so he kind of sets the stage of how God has been working, hence the brevity of the creation account. He didn't write it to explain to us how God created everything, and so we get a briefer account there than what we would like. The method that we're going to be using to interpret it is called faith. By faith, we understand this creation process. The writer to the Hebrews tells us that in 11:3. And that's the principle we're going to use. We're not going to go to alternative explanations from men, to scientific analysis or stuff like that. We're going to accept what God says in His Word. That's faith, taking God at His Word. That's going to be our interpretation approach all the way through this book and any other book of the Bible. We interpret it by faith. Last week we saw day one in the beginning of the process. It looked like maybe it was sort of a two-step deal. It looks like maybe in verse one God pulled together this giant watery blob of all of the elements that we know of. Remember, we looked briefly at the periodic chart, and you really enjoy going over the periodic chart, but we just didn't have time to mess with that thing. So, but on that chart are all the things that we know about, all of the ones found in God's creation, and even the ones that have been synthesized by men. And it looks like God pulled all that stuff together in this big watery blob, because in verse 2 says, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. So nothing was happening yet, and it was dark. So the blob looks like maybe it was pulled together, all the raw materials that he was going to use, but there was no way of seeing anything yet. And so God said, verse 3, let there be light. He created light on the very first day. The first thing, well, if he pulled this blob together, you could say, well, the first thing he did was create all the elements he was going to use. But the first thing that's specifically stated is that he created light. Where'd you get that light? There was no sun. There were no stars. There were no incandescent light bulbs. There were no ionized gases in fluorescent tubes. Where'd that light come from? We're not told, but it probably came from the Lord himself. He probably lit up things from his own brilliance and his own glory. We just don't know. But this light was not the light that we're going to get on day four. We'll talk about that when we get to day four. This was just light in terms of a concept, and he separated it from darkness. And so that was the first thing that he did on the first day, was to create just light and separate it from darkness. But he also has this, what we are thinking is some kind of a big, large blob of watery elements that he's going to use. So day one was pulling together, it looks like, the raw materials and the concept of light. And he marked that off for us in time as calling it day one. There was evening and there was morning, one day. Well, can you have a day without a sun? Of course you can. One revolution of the planet marks a day, doesn't it? You don't have to have a sun. You can have a time marker that just is the rotation of the planet. Maybe that's what is referred to there. Maybe that's how he's marking time right now. Verse 2 said that God was moving, the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. That's kind of a hovering-like maneuver. And it may be that the Holy Spirit was interacting with that large watery blob. Maybe that's how we got gravity. I don't know. We're not told where gravity came from, but perhaps his interaction with the planet instilled that in it somehow, and that's where we got it. I don't know. Maybe or maybe not. Also, we're not told where the Earth's magnetic field came from either in Scripture. Maybe that was part of the Holy Spirit's activity there early on. I don't know. You know, the Earth has a magnetic field. Are you familiar with it? Are you familiar with magnets at all? If you just take a bar magnet with the north and south pole, lay it down amongst a bunch of iron filings, and you'll see these lines going around like that, called lines of flux. The Earth has something like that. If you took the Earth and put that bar magnet in it and tilted it about 10 degrees off center, that's where the Earth's magnetic field is oriented. It's a little bit off center from the shape of the Earth. That's there too. We don't know where that came from. He doesn't say. But it's important that it's there because it blocks a lot of the bad radiation from the sun. That's a nice protective shield that the Earth needs. And so that's in place at some point throughout this first week. We don't know where. Exactly when, but I'm just suspicious that maybe this initial activity on the part of the Holy Spirit in verse 2 might include both gravity and that magnetic field. I don't know. At any rate, somehow or another they get there. But that's kind of what went on in day 1. Definitely involved the Holy Spirit's activity. Let's pick up the trail now at verse 6 of chapter 1. Then God said, now remember, this is how he brings everything into existence. He just speaks it. Pretty cool, huh? How'd you like to be able to do that? Speak something into existence from non-existence. He's the only one that can do that. And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters and let it separate the waters from the waters. Page 24 in your handout is a picture that looks something like this. The picture is trying to capture the divisions of the water here that took place on day 2. Remember, we got this watery blob, we think, something like that. And now on day 2, God separates the waters down here, which is going to be where the earth is in just a little bit, from waters up above it. He separates that watery mass that he created into two regions of water. One's down here, and one's up there. And trying to draw it, it kind of looks like it's got a real sharp edge, doesn't it, off the top and bottom. Probably not like that. It's probably a vapor, probably a water vapor that expands on out into space and would probably get a little less as you go along. I don't know. But he separated the water, one from the other, from the ones down here on Earth, from the ones up above. So it forms something different than what we know of today. And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. So on day 2, things are starting to look something like that. Water on the earth and water up in the heavens, up in the air, up above the earth. And he started naming things. He called the expanse heaven. So all of this stuff up above the earth is referred to by God. He just defines it for us, names it for us as heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, a second day. So in day 2, we get the atmosphere and some sort of a large collection, a massive collection of water vapor up there above it. Now, this is a significant thing to think about for a little bit because it will explain a bunch of things for us that happened between here and the flood and up through the flood. Yeah.
The Earth's core.
Hang on a minute. We'll get that sucker up here in just a little bit. Right now, all we know is we got this big watery blob of a planet-like thing, and it apparently is turning, because he's marking time now by these days. And then up above it is another massive collection of water, probably in vapor form. I don't think there's another river flowing up above the planet, but it's probably water vapor. And the reason that makes some sense to us is because if that indeed is a big, massive collection of water vapor, what we have here on day two is kind of like a greenhouse. See, the planet down here is, in essence, blocked from radiation and other things by this massive amount of water up there. You have sort of like a canopy, then, forming a greenhouse-like circumstance here on the Earth. If that's the case, that would help explain why the temperatures were probably uniform throughout the Earth. If this is what we're trying to describe did indeed happen, then you would have relatively uniform temperatures. You wouldn't have airflow stirring up all kinds of storms and things like that going on. There's no rain, so that you don't have a hydrological system that's evaporating waters from here up into the expanse and those condensing and falling back down like we have now. So, no rain yet. You would have no polar ice caps. If this thing is uniform in temperature, there's nothing to freeze the ice caps or anything like that. All of which tends to help explain why the life expectancy was so long back during this time frame. These guys lived 800-900 years. How'd they do that? Not with the radiation that tears us up every day, was it? Now, these idyllic conditions that this system right here might have formed helps to explain the long life, the lushness of the planet, and all kinds of things like that. And it also helps to explain where did the water come from for the flood. If you condense all of the water that's in the Earth's atmosphere today, it'll cover the planet to a depth of 1 or 2 inches. There's not enough water vapor up there to flood this planet. But there was before the flood, I think. And I think the way God flooded this place was not only did he release the water from within the planet, but he crashed this huge water vapor canopy that was above the planet down onto it. And that's what's going to, I think, help to explain the flood. If you take your watering pot out there and it's got that little spray thingy on the end and you water your pot with that gentle rain, the pot can handle it, can't it? Take that thing off and dump that pot on and see what happens. Just washes it away, doesn't it? The erosion capability of water is fantastic. And I think that kind of stuff there is where the Grand Canyon came from. Not millions of years of the Colorado River, but a few days, a few weeks of this canopy crashing down on the Earth can just cut all kinds of ravines and things. And so if it is something like what we think here, it helps to explain a lot of things about the conditions before the flood and at the time of the flood, if indeed that's what it was. So that's why we think that something like that was probably the case. That was day two. We get the water and the atmosphere. Okay, day three, at verse 9, then God said, Dave, here's your answer to your question. Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. Go ahead.
But underneath the water, all the seas today, the earth underneath the sea is the sea bed. So if I think of the core of the earth, not just the land that we're on today, sit here right now, very cool. The earth is a rock. The seas don't go all the way through.
Well, what looks like happened here, again, we're speculating because we don't know for certain, but in bringing forth the dry land from that water, what he's done in essence is just simply pull up the land and recede the water down into where it's going to be in its final place, which is today's oceans. There's a few other places in Scripture where this description is given to us. Let me read you a few of these. You can kind of get a little bit of a sense or a feel of this. In Job 38, he's talking to Job. He says, "Now prepare yourself like a man. I'll question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" That's what he's doing here. "Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched a line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." We'll come back to that in a bit. That's angels singing praises to God when he did this on this day. So they're here. But how long have they been here? We'll talk about that later. And then on day three, the Lord's describing it himself in verses 8 through 11 of Job 38. "Or who shut the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the room? When I made the clouds its garment and the thick darkness its swaddling band? When I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, then I said, 'Thus far you may come, but no farther. Here your proud waves must stop.'" That's a description of God establishing the landmass and the oceans of the world here on day three. Now, you've got, well, maybe you don't have this either. But here's an interesting picture. Can you see that at all? I don't think it's any better out of the sleeve, but let me try it. That's a little better, isn't it? You see how the continents of the earth sort of fit together? See, the description we have here is of one landmass. When he brought the dry ground out, it didn't come out as some muddy mess. It's dry ground. It looks like there was only one mass of earth on the planet in addition to the water. It rose up, the water went down, and you had what amounted to a massive one continent picture here on the earth. And then it looks like it got fractured or fragmented, I think at the flood, and broke into what we have today. So you see how if you move those things back together, it looks like they fit quite nicely into one mass of land, which is being described here. So that's why I think that's probably what happened there. And he named the dry land Earth. Know what that name is? Adamah. The earth is the Hebrew word Adamah. A-D-A-M-A-H. Where'd Adam come from? Adam came from Adamah. So he named the earth Adamah. And the gathering of the waters he called the seas. And God saw that it was good. So on day three, we've got the landmass appearing on the earth and the oceans defined by God. He set their limits to where they could flow and couldn't flow any further. And we got this one landmass. All right, and then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them on the earth," and it was so. Now that he's got the dry ground up where it can produce something, he now brings forth vegetation. Now notice this vegetation already has reproductive capabilities. It already has seeds in it. You see that? These are mature trees and fruit-bearing things. I've been told, I don't know if this is true for sure, but I think it takes 12 years for a banana tree to produce bananas. 12 years. Not when God makes them. They're producing bananas as soon as they hit the ground. They have seeds within them. They're created with the appearance of age. They look like they've been around for a while already, because they have seeds in them, they're producing fruit already, and it just looks like it's been here for some time already. And notice that there are limits to what they can do. After their kind is how they're produced. God put genetic silos around his creation so that they can only reproduce within certain variations. Peach trees cannot produce apples. Orange seeds cannot grow you a pear tree. There are genetic limits even in the plant world that we see here on day three. And God said, "Hey, this is okay. It's good." And it was so. They did what he told them to do. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, there was morning, a third day. Now the evolutionist thinks that animals came before plants. What did the animals eat if they came first? Each other? That's all that's there, right? But the Bible says that plants came first, like you would expect it to be. He's preparing an environment for man and animals to live in. And so the first order of business, get those plants out there for people got something to eat. And animals do. And so that's the order that he prepared it in. Check my notes and make sure there's nothing else I wanted to mention to you. Yeah. Nothing that we need to worry about. Okay, so on day three, you got vegetation sprouting all over the place. You got the land mass of the earth coming up. Now today we know it's fragmented into about seven major continents, but back then it looks like it was all just one big mass of land. Would that not help to explain why you can find fossils of mammoths from one side of the earth to the other? If it was all one landmass originally, they could be anywhere, couldn't they? Now when it gets broken up later at the flood, then it gets separated by large distances and it looks a lot harder to explain. But it's not hard to explain if it was just like what the Bible says. Those critters could be anywhere later on when they're created. They're not here yet, but one landmass allows them to migrate to go anywhere they want to go. All right, verse 14, and God said, this is day four, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. Day four, now we actually get something that generates light. We didn't have that before. We had the Lord himself, but not light generators. Talk to you for a minute about light. Light isn't the one that comes from things like this. It's an interesting concept. This chart shows a spectrum of electromagnetic energy. Electromagnetic energy has an unusual trait in that it has the properties of a wave front. You study it and you analyze it and you think of it as a wave. But it also has properties of particles. Electromagnetic energy has an electric field in one plane, a magnetic field perpendicular to it in another plane, electromagnetic energy. But at the junction of those two fields is a little packet of energy called a photon. If you use a little rule of curling the E field, the electric field, down over the magnetic field with your right hand, your thumb will point in the direction of propagation, in case you won't know that. So that field of energy will propagate in a certain direction. Electromagnetic energy. An electric field, a magnetic field, perpendicular to one another, oscillating at various frequencies, anywhere from very, very low frequencies with long wavelengths to very, very high frequencies, X-rays and stuff up there, with extremely small wavelengths. That's how these ham operators can talk to people halfway around the world. The frequencies that they're operating down here are down at this low end, and the wavelengths are like miles long. They transmit them and they bounce them off the ionosphere of the earth, and they come back down over in Africa, and they're talking to some guy in Africa. Of course, today, if you call a helpline for any of these software companies, you're talking to people in New Delhi. So why is that any better, you know? But anyway, they're actually talking to them off of their radios. But this spectrum of energy now goes from very, very long wavelengths and very small frequencies all the way up to very, very high frequencies like X-rays and gamma ray. You can't see an X-ray when someone takes a picture of you, can you? You don't see the X-rays. Like too fast. But there's a spectrum within this vast spectrum of electromagnetic energy, and it's right there. And oddly enough, your eye and your brain can process that electromagnetic energy. All those little photons occurring right there in that frequency spectrum, your brain can actually handle. It's called light. That's how you see. And that stuff comes into your eye, collects on your retina, sent down to your optic nerve, shift over to your brain, and all them little photons of energy are processed by your brain. It's doing things with it, and you can look around and you can see stuff. But you can't see way down in frequency or way up in frequency. It's just that little notch that you can process with your eye and brain. That's light, electromagnetic energy. So there's a small portion of it that is what we see and how we function and so on with light. Now, I want to mention a thing or two to you just for safety's sake. Yeah, I don't need to find that anyway. You see this little spectrum right here that says radar? You have a little radar-like thing in your microwave oven. There's a tube in there called a magnetron, and it generates electromagnetic energy, cooks your food. What happens to an egg when you put an egg into a hot skillet? What happens to the white? Does it stay clear? No, it turns white, doesn't it? The lens in your eye is protein just like the white of that egg. And what heat does to that egg, electromagnetic energy, RF energy, radar energy will do to the lens in your eye. It will cook your eye lens and make it permanently opaque and will blind you. That's why they have that grid on the front of your microwave oven door so that that energy can't get through there. Don't ever expose your eyes knowingly to electromagnetic energy. It will destroy your lens in your eye. Can you understand that now? It's just a little safety feature there, so just be careful of that. At any rate, throughout this whole frequency spectrum here, you can see that little bit right there. So when God said, let there be light, the only part of it that you know anything about is just that little bit right there, the part that your eye can process and you can see. You understand all that okay? You don't need to know the detail of it, but just know that you can process a little bit of electromagnetic energy from that vast spectrum. You can process a little bit of it, and you are processing it, and you can see. Okay, that's what that's about. So, these objects that he puts out there are for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. They're time markers. They tell us things. He's put a bunch of stuff out there in space that enable us to sense the passage of time and mark certain seasons and things so that we can use those objects for our well-being. If you know how to do it, and I don't, sailors can use the positioning of these things in such a way as to actually navigate the surface of this planet. They can look up there and they can see these things that are millions and millions and millions of miles away and do things with them and know how to actually go around on the surface of this planet. They're signs for sailors if they know how to use them, and for seasons and for years. Let them be for lights in the expanse of heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. The positioning of all of those things is for the benefit of life on this planet. Among the things he positions, he mentions next, God made the two greater lights. He made the two great lights. The reason Moses, I think, doesn't say sun and moon is because those were both gods in Egypt. They had the sun god, they had the moon god, and I don't think he wanted to imply in any way that worshiping them made sense, so he just refers to them as a great light and a lesser light, but he's talking about the sun and the moon. Here's an interesting picture of the relative size of the greater light to the other planets in our solar system. Can you even see the Earth on there? It's right there. See that little one there? That's the Earth. Like a pinhead compared to the size of this big ball over here. The greater light is a nuclear reactor. It's the sun. It's a fusion reactor. It fuses hydrogen atoms into helium atoms in its core. Scientists think that it might be about 50 million degrees in the core of the sun. And that energy from that fusion action radiates out through the sun, eventually reaching the sun's surface, and radiates omnidirectionally from the sun out into all of space, all directions at once, everywhere. And the little sliver of that that comes to our planet is enough to heat and light this planet. That electromagnetic energy we just talked about, that comes from the sun's center all the way over to the Earth in an omnidirectional manner. And so, what, 99% of it goes somewhere else? Just that little 1% or so that we get here? 93 million miles away. Not 94, not 92. 93 million miles away allows that energy to get to this planet in just such a way to heat it properly. It doesn't burn us up. You can lay out in the sun for a while and you may think you got burnt up, but it won't cook you, and you won't freeze to death because it's 93 million miles away exactly. And that energy, heat energy and light energy, is put there relative to our planet by God for the explicit purpose of lighting the planet, greater light by day, and the moon a lesser light by night. And God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And by the way, in verse 16, he also made the stars also. He made the stars to just kind of an afterthought, almost a throwaway. Here's a picture of the earth. About 25,000 miles in circumference. I've walked around it about four times in the last 40 years, and I never moved more than that far right there. All on a treadmill. About a 25,000 mile circumference. Remember the formula for circumference? Pi times the diameter. Diameter is about 8,000 miles through the earth. 8,000 miles. The surface area of the earth is about 6,000 trillion square feet. Right now I'm occupying about one of those. 1 square foot. 6,000 trillion square feet, and I got my one. Not very significant, am I? I'm a speck on the earth. And if we consider where the Earth is relative to our solar system, here's the next shot. That shot actually comes into this one. Here's a picture of the solar system down here. About 8 billion miles across our solar system from the furthest planet into the sun. 8 billion miles. That Earth that we just talked about, 25,000 mile circumference, 8,000 mile diameter, whatever you want to think of it as, it's a speck in the 8 billion mile wide solar system in which we exist. We're a speck on a speck. And that solar system goes into our Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is about 600,000 trillion miles across the Milky Way galaxy, our galaxy. Our solar system is a speck in the Milky Way galaxy. So I am a speck on a speck on a speck in God's creation. If you went a trillion miles, you would have to go 600,000 times that to get across our galaxy. And there are perhaps billions of galaxies in God's universe. And Moses accounts for that and says, he made the stars also. There's the accounting of that. It is incomprehensibly large, and we can't begin to grasp what God has done here. So we are specks on a speck on a speck on a speck. And the psalmist says in Psalm 8, says, when I think about all the things that you did and what you made and everything, what is man that you pay any attention to him? It's a fair question, isn't it? And every one of those celestial bodies that God has made, he put in exactly the right place for the benefit of this planet, and he knows every one of their names. Every one of those trillions of created objects, he knows their names. He can call them forth by name. And he's put things in where he wants them to be to the benefit of this planet. See Jupiter up there on that deal? This big guy right here? That's the largest planet, which means it has the largest gravitational field of any of them. Jupiter's like a big guard dog for the universe. The gravitational field of Jupiter is so strong that it snatches up and grabs space junk, asteroids and things like that that's flying around out there that could come crashing into the other planets. Jupiter grabs them because of its gravitational field and pulls them into its own environment. That's a big guard dog that God put out there to protect us. It's not there by happenstance, by chance. It's there because it's exactly where God wanted it to be, to help preserve and promote life on this planet. And on day 4, he just put all that stuff out there. He spoke it into place. Trillions and trillions of objects in exactly where he wanted them to be for the benefit of life on this planet. God placed him in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And the evolutionists want to think that all that stuff just happened. It was a big bang of some kind. Something just exploded somewhere. Where did that come from, by the way? Something just exploded and all this stuff just worked perfectly and everything is in good harmony and everything just works perfectly. The sun's exactly 93 million miles away. Not 94, not 92, but 93, so that it warms and lights the planet perfectly. And they want you to believe that it all just happened. What an insult to God. He told us how it happened. And we come up with stuff like that and throw that in his face? To govern the day and the night, to separate the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, a fourth day. Day 4, it looks like he was busy, wasn't he? I don't know why he didn't rest on day 5. He was probably tuckered out from day 4. All those trillions of things he had to build and put out there all at once. Why did he wait till day 7? And on day 1, all he did was create light. Seems like a little imbalanced, doesn't it? One thing on day 1 and trillions of things on day 4. God created it however he wanted to create it, and that's the way it was. Then verse 20, God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. Ah, new order of creation. Here it is. Living creatures. These guys are living. And let the birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the water swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Day 5, we get to go fishing and we get to go duck hunting. Sea life and air life created on day 5 there. All of the stuff that lived in the oceans, he creates on that day. This would include your big stuff, your whales and any of those dinosaur-type critters that lived in the water, whatever. They're there. They're teeming. They're swarming. They're not just there. They're there in great abundance on day 5. And God said to them, look, be fruitful and multiply. That is, these things were created with the ability to multiply. They're adult animals, adult critters, able to reproduce and multiply the day they hit the ground running. And fill the waters in the seas and the birds and multiply on the earth. The Creator created creators. These critters are supposed to multiply. They're supposed to reproduce. They're supposed to create new life. So the Creator created things that can create new life on day five. Evening and morning, a fifth day, the planet revolved one more time. And so it was a fifth day. Then God said, verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind. Notice where the critters came from here on day six. They came from the earth. Now, on the seas, they didn't come from the waters. They didn't come from the seas. He created them. But on this day, the land critters came forth from the earth. They're made out of the same stuff that the earth is made out of. That's why they can go back to it. They just dissolve away back to the same place from which they came. Those elements that we looked at on the periodic chart that were in the earth when God created it are the things that are in animals today. And so they came forth from the earth, living creatures after their kind. Again, there are limitations here on the genetic reproducibility of critters. You can't cross a 5,000 pound elephant with a cheetah and get an animal that big that can run 60 miles an hour. It can't happen. God put limits there. After their kind, the genetic codes of those animals could only vary slightly, if any, to reproduce. So you can't get that kind of a mixture. And he lists some of the categories here. Cattle, and creeping things, not creepy things, creeping things. Some of them might be a little creepy to us, but you got your land animals like cattle, your grazers and so on. Remember we said he made the vegetation first. What are those grazers going to eat? Those vegetations, that's why they came first. Now you start filling these fields with these grazers and they got something to eat on day one. He couldn't put things down here that didn't have a source of food until the source of food had been made, which it has. Then you got the creeping things. I guess that's all the, I don't know, alligators and snakes and that kind of stuff. I don't know. And it would be any of the dinosaurs. Remember, most of them are reptiles. So they were created on this day. Dinosaurs are created things like anything else was on day six. And the beasts of the earth, which I guess would be like the big stuff, elephants and bears and tigers and oh my, whatever. So he saw all that and it was after their kind, and it was so. So God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind, and God saw that it was good. This stuff is working out the way God wanted it to. And then we come to verse 26. But verse 26 is going to have to wait till next week.
No.
There's too much going on there to get done in the next 10 minutes, so we won't go into verse 26 yet today. What have we seen here so far? First 6 days, actually not even through with the sixth day. He takes that big watery blob that we're suspecting was there containing all the different elements that there was, and he separates them into two sets of water, one above the air mass and then one down here on the earth. Then he brings the dry ground up out of the watery mass here that we call the earth. One continent, one mass of land, not what we see today, but one mass of land. Then he creates a bunch of stuff growing out of the earth so that it can feed the inhabitants of the planet. Fruits, veggies, all that stuff start appearing and growing, and they appear as adult plants. Stuff's already there to eat, seeds already in them, it's already able to reproduce and all that sort of stuff. Then he creates all of the heavenly realm that we know about, the sun and the moon, and all these billions and billions of terrestrial bodies out there. Now, how did the light get from these terrestrial bodies that are so far away that it takes thousands and thousands and thousands of years to get here? How did that light get here on day one? How did he tie in the light that they emit from those distances that it got all the way back here to the planet so it could be seen during Adam's lifetime, for example? He told it to get moving. Get out there. Apparently he tied that in as he put those things out there. Apparently he tied the stream of light from the earth to them together as he placed them there, so that you have all of these vast distances of planets still being seen, the light from them that scientists think left there 43 billion years ago and just now reached the earth. No, it got there at the same time he put them there. So that would explain why you can have planets that are great, great distances away, and yet the light is striking the earth, and the earth is not billions of years old or trillions of years old. If he can make the constellation or the, yeah, constellation is good enough, if he can put that out there a couple trillion light years away, can he not move the light with it? It seemed to me like one's just as easy as the other, so I don't see any great problem with that, but some people do, but I don't think it amounts to anything. But he put them all out there, and he named them, and he can call every one of them by name. He knows how many hair are growing on your head. For some of us, not such a big number. For others, pretty good mental capacity being demonstrated. Yeah, he knows all of these things because he made them, he put them in place. He chided Job somewhat about Job thinking that he knew so much about God and what God should be doing. Job always thought he got the shaft from God. So God's talking to him and he tells him a little bit about all this stuff, brings some of this back to his mind, and makes Job obviously realize that Job can't question the Creator. The creation has no right whatsoever to question the Creator. And it looks like maybe Job learned that lesson okay there, because he responds positively. All right, any questions or comments about what we've seen here so far? 6 days of creation, not through with day six yet. We got to get another critter on the planet. And we'll get him and her on here next time. So everything so far now, it's been a very orderly process. He's put things together in exact order that makes good sense, prepared it for habitation and for life, put the habitation there, the life there, and now he's moving up to the kind of the climax of that life when we see what he made in man. But we need to talk about that a little bit more than what we got time for here yet today. Questions or comments about what we're seeing so far? Yes, Carol.
In the end times, when God creates a new heaven, do you think all the planets and stars and everything will be changed too?
I would think so, because the reason they're there now is to support the life on this planet. We won't need that kind of support then. So I don't know why there would be anything other than the planet on which our heavenly Jerusalem sits. Maybe there will be, I don't know. But I don't know why there would be.
Right.
We won't need anything more.
Okay.
We don't even need the sun. We won't get a sun. Mm-hmm. He'll light the place with his own self. So I would think it might be quite simplified over what we have now. But I don't know for sure. Yeah, Ken?
What's all this commotion about September the 26th? Some saying the end of the world is going to happen on the
26th. Oh, yeah. Forget that nonsense. Yeah. Now, anybody that's going to put a date on it, just ignore them immediately. They don't know. Any other questions or comments?
Don,
yeah.
What did you do in your past life? Tell me what your occupation was.
I built radars for Texas Instruments and Raytheon. I was electrical engineer. I can tell you about radars, but not much else. I know they can hurt you, so be careful. One of the properties of them is called the Doppler effect. If you transmit a certain frequency of a radar out and it strikes something, it'll bounce back to you at exactly the same frequency, unless that object is moving. If it's moving, what the signal that comes back shifts in frequency. So you can scale all that and process all that, and so if you have a moving object and you hit it with a radar beam and it comes back to you, you can tell how fast that moving object is moving away from you. And that's what the cops use, called Doppler radar, and the principle is that of a Doppler shift in frequency to clue them in on what you're doing. Now, the radiation from the sun, electromagnetic radiation from the sun, can harm you. It can destroy your cells, and does. That's why those protective belts out there, the Earth's magnetic field and these two radiation belts, the Van Allen belts are called, are out there in place. It blocks a lot of that stuff. So that if we don't have that, not only will the planet overheat, but so will you. And those the damaging effects of radiation can tear your cells up. What is cancer treatment? Radiate and kill cells with a beam of electromagnetic energy. That's exactly what's going on all day, every day, out there in the atmosphere. All this energy is out there, and it's destructive to human cells, and we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. But there are things that God has put into place to protect us from these sources of energy, heat and light energy, that sustain life on the planet. He's put protectors out there so that we can live here. Remember, they used to live 900 years in the Old Testament. Before that canopy was taken away at the flood, I think, you got Adam living over 900 years, Methuselah, what, 960 out in through there, stuff like that. And after the flood, that life expectancy rate just starts coming right on down. Gets down about 120 by the time you get to Abraham, because that protector's not there anymore. So the effects of those things are there, and they're destructive, and they take their toll. Any other questions or comments about what we've seen so far? Okay. All right, we'll let you roll. You guys have a good week. Stay out of that harmful sun as best you can.